headlines. The leader of Ansarullah Movement says Yemenis will continue resistance against the U.S. and Saudi aggression until they achieve independence and freedom. Iran's president says that Tehran is determined to expand ties with Latin American states, particularly Venezuela. Also in the headlines, the coronavirus crisis in Russia shows no sign of letting up as the country records a new all-time high in its cases. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Ansarullah Movement accuses the U.S. and Saudi Arabia of committing, quote, the most horrible crimes since Riyadh began its war in Yemen.
I call on our people, the Yemen of faith, the sons of faith, to continue their efforts to face the aggression, the American-Saudi aggression, which continues for a seventh year, to commit the most horrible crimes against our people and continues to enforce sanctions and a blockade on our people.
Abdelmalek al-Houthi was addressing Yemeni people at nationwide rallies held to celebrate the birth anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad. He said the Yemenis will continue their resistance against Saudi-led aggressors until the full liberation of their land from occupiers. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., launched a devastating war against Yemen in 2015 to reinstall the country's former Riyadh-friendly regime. The onslaught has led to the death of tens of thousands of Yemenis, most of them women and children. Abdel Latif al-Washali says that the Yemeni people remain supportive of the army and demand the liberation of their country from Saudi-led invaders.
They are really proud of the achievements of the Yemeni army. They keep supporting the Yemeni army with men, with money, with food, with everything. They support the army as they believe that this army and also the local tribesmen are defending their land from the occupation, from the invaders. And I mean here Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Yemenis believe that the Saudi-backed forces in Ma'arib should be expelled as soon as possible. The spokesman of the Yemeni army confirmed that thousands of kilometers have been liberated from the Saudi-backed forces. The city of Ma'arib is now encircled from all sides, and the Yemeni army keeps advancing toward the city. They want to kneel the city, to force the forces inside the city to leave the city without the power of the guns and the weapons, as the city is filled with civilians. So the Yemeni army will continue its advancements, and after liberating Ma'arib, Yemenis believe that the army should move and go further to liberate the eastern governorates, including Shabwa and other governorates, and also the southern cities in Yemen from the Emirati and Saudi occupation. Yemenis are really proud of their army, and they will keep supporting their army until the liberation of all the Yemeni territories.
Iran says it is pursuing the policy of expanding ties with countries in the Latin American region. President Ibrahim Raisi says that Tehran is seeking to expand ties with nations that stand against hegemonic states. Raisi said the development of ties with Latin American countries is among Iran's diplomatic and economic priorities. The Iranian president said that Tehran and Caracas need to have long-term plans to improve their bilateral ties. Raisi made the comments in a meeting with the visiting Venezuelan foreign minister. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister has said that Tehran and Caracas are set to sign a 20-year cooperation agreement soon.
In the coming months, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro will travel to Tehran, and during his visit, Iran and Venezuela will sign a 20-year cooperation agreement. It proves that bilateral ties between Tehran and Caracas are on a developing path.
Emir Abdullahian expressed Tehran's readiness to expand ties with Venezuela in all fields, including energy and technology. The top Iranian diplomat also slammed the U.S. pursuing a hostile policy against Venezuela. For his part, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister Felix Plasencia Gonzalez expressed hope that Tehran and Caracas can draw a roadmap to expand their long-term cooperation. Commentator Marcus Papadopoulos says the strategic partnership between Venezuela and Iran is a matter of concern for the U.S., which wants Caracas in its sphere of influence.
In recent years, Latin America has witnessed the formation of a strategic partnership between Venezuela and Iran. For policymakers in Washington, this is an increasingly worrying development in Latin America, because of course, historically, Latin America is America's backyard, so to speak. It is America's sphere of influence. Washington will look to try and destabilize the strategic partnership that Iran has with Venezuela.
The Venezuelan government and the U.S.-backed opposition started their latest round of negotiations in August, hoping to finally reach consensus to alleviate the country's political and economic crisis. However, the talks are facing a deadlock after a member of the government's negotiating team was arrested, then extradited to the U.S.
The face-off between the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro and the opposition led by Juan Guaido has put Caracas in a years-long political impasse and economic crisis. Several rounds of talks in recent years have been futile, and the two sides have failed to reach a consensus. In August, the Venezuelan government and the opposition began a new round of negotiations in Mexico City aimed at overcoming Venezuela's political and economic crisis. The dialogue was mediated by Norway. However, the latest developments have hampered the process of a possible settlement. Venezuela's government had decided to suspend the talks after Cape Verde extradited a Venezuelan envoy named Alex Saab to the United States on money laundering charges on Saturday. Saab was arrested in Cape Verde under a U.S. arrest warrant in June 2020 when his plane stopped there to refuel. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro lashed out at the U.S. for what he called kidnapping of an envoy to face an American court.
Saab was taken yesterday, skirting over everything. A plane arrived, assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows from the jail he was held. They took him without advising lawyers, the family, nobody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
Jorge Rodriguez, who heads the government's negotiating team, described the government's decision as a deep expression of protest over the brutal aggression against Alex Saab. He also called on Washington to release Saab immediately.
Venezuela is alerting the world that the life of Alex Saab is in danger. It's in the hands of judicial system that is directed at harming Venezuela. And we demand his immediate release by the American government.
The U.S. charged Saab in 2019 in connection with a bribery scheme and sanctioned him for allegedly orchestrating a corruption network that allowed Caracas to profit from a state-run food subsidy program. However, Saab's lawyers have denied the U.S. charges as politically motivated.
This is absolutely a political attack on Venezuela, and it is a kidnapping. This shows just how far in lawlessness the United States is willing to go and how much they are determined to attack Venezuela.
Meanwhile, U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido reacted to the decision to suspend the talks, accusing the government of evading the nation's problems. Caracas aims to ease U.S.-led sanctions on the Venezuelan nation, while the opposition says it aims to use the talks to secure guarantees for regional elections to be held in the fall.
Washington has followed a policy of regime change in Venezuela. The U.S. and several of its Western allies have backed the opposition leader Juan Guaido and have used sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro. Meanwhile, Caracas blames the U.S. sanctions for the country's current economic crisis.
Venezuela descended into political turmoil after U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. Then, the United States refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation, and froze millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in the U.S. bank account. Washington has been using sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro in what has been termed economic terrorism. Venezuela has faced chronic shortages of food and medicine as a result of U.S. sanctions, resulting in years of political and economic crisis.
Well, this is exactly what the U.S. government wants to prevent. And this may be also an effort on their part to sabotage even the negotiations going on in Mexico. That how can the talks continue in this situation? But what needs to be condemned and denounced is depriving any country of food and medicine, particularly in this time of pandemic.
While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new, the U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but further complicate the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst a full-blown crisis.
The number of coronavirus cases in Russia has topped 8 million amid a sluggish vaccination drive in the country. The Russian health officials reported more than 34,000 infections in the last 24 hours. The figure is the highest single-day case tally since the start of the pandemic. Russia also reported nearly 1,000 daily deaths, pushing the total tally to over 224,300 fatalities. Russia has been fighting a new wave of infections in recent weeks, which has forced the health ministry to ask retired vaccinated medics to return to hospitals. Officials blame the surge on people's reluctance to get vaccinated. So far, just nearly 33% of the Russians have received jabs. The Russian foreign minister says that his country is suspending its mission to NATO as tensions deepen between Moscow and the Western military alliance.
In response to NATO's actions, we are suspending the work of our official mission to NATO, including the work of our military representative from November 1st, although it may take a few more days.
Sergei Lavrov also said that Russia would close NATO's liaison mission, as well as its information office in Moscow. Earlier this month, the military alliance expelled 8 Russian diplomats over espionage allegations. NATO officials said that the move is aimed at strengthening the alliance's deterrence in response to, quote, Russia's aggressive actions. Moscow denounced the decision, saying that it undermined efforts to normalize ties between Russia and NATO. Former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell has died at the age of 84. Powell's family said that he died of COVID-19 complications despite being fully vaccinated. Appointed chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1989, Powell oversaw the invasion of Panama and the Persian Gulf War against Iraq. He became the first African-American to serve as the U.S. Secretary of State in 2001 under the former President George W. Bush. In 2003, Powell made a controversial presentation to the U.S. Security Council about alleged weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The evidence used to justify the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of the Arab country was later proven to be false. Scott Ritter is a former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq who joins us from Bethlehem in New York. Scott Ritter, welcome. So when you take a look at what has happened, this passing away of Powell, what do you remember him by?
Well, what stands out to me is that this was a man of great intelligence and, for the most part, a strong moral compass who could have been one of the great figures in American history. He had topped out, so to speak, as the Secretary of State, but this was a man who had potential to become the President of the United States. Indeed, had he run in either 1996 or 2000, he would have been the first black president of the United States, in my opinion. And he's somebody that I would have, at the time of those elections, had he run, supported wholeheartedly. I had a number of experiences with Colin Powell throughout my history, and all of them were positive up until the last one, which was, of course, his presentation to the United Nations Security Council in February of 2002, selling a false case for war that he knew to be false. And unfortunately, this act nullified a history of tremendous public service. And I think Colin Powell, unfortunately, is going to go down in history as a man who betrayed that which he claimed to stand for by supporting a case for war that he knew to be false. Colin Powell was a man with a unique military career, and what I mean by that is that he combined, combat experience in Vietnam in the formative part of careers with a career that was largely political, starting in the 1970s, working as a White House intern under the Nixon administration. He was a deputy national security advisor, then later a national security advisor for President Reagan. Then he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for Papa Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, during the Gulf War. For most people with a military background, you would say, okay, that's a man doing his job. That's a man doing, his duty. And while he, served a president, in this case, George Herbert Walker Bush, very closely, he served the nation. The nation took, dominance. But I think the fact of the matter is Colin Powell owed his success to Reagan, to Bush, and to the people that surrounded him, James Baker, Brent Scowcroft, and others. And he was extremely loyal to them, so loyal that when the ultimate test of personal integrity came to pass, where he would have to stand up and confront the son of a man whom he respected. He respected George Herbert Walker Bush. He did not respect George W. Bush, but he served George W. Bush, and he ultimately was unable to do that which his honor, his code of ethics, required him to do, stand up and call the president out on his false case for war, and threatened to resign and ultimately resign from his position as Secretary of State should the president continue to push a false case for war. But he didn't, out of loyalty to Bush's father. And I think that's what prompted him to do something that ran against his grain. I mean, this is a man who wrote books and gave speeches about the importance of personal integrity, about standing up for the facts, not bending under political pressure. And yet, in the end, he bent under political pressure and delivered a presentation to the United Nations Security Council that history has shown to be false in its entirety.
Thank you so much for that. We appreciate that. That's Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, from Bethlehem, New York. Many thanks, Scott. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Imam Khomeini once said in a historic address, as today world peace is such that all countries are under the political influence of the superpowers. They observe a control everywhere and have schemes to defeating every group. The most important of these is sowing discord among brothers. Muslims should be awake. Muslims should be alert that if a dispute takes place among Sunni and Shiite brothers, it is harmful to all of us. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, he has PhD on Islamic science.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Inshallah, we will be talking about the topic of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam in the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini. And through his life, obviously, he had many speeches, and since we know that he is a jurist as well, whom we generally know as the representative of Imam Mahdi. So, inshallah, we will be looking at his viewpoints in regards to Imam Mahdi. The very first part of a speech that I have today is related to the waiting of Imam Mahdi, intizarul faraj. That's generally... we know, obviously, we have heard this word. We are waiting for Imam Mahdi. When we are waiting for Imam Mahdi, obviously, this waiting has value in Islam, has value in the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu
many narrations which talk about the waiting of Imam Mahdi, that the last savior, Imam Mahdi, the 12th Imam, will go to the occultation, and there are people who are waiting for it. So Imam Khomeini mentions that we should serve those who are waiting for Imam Mahdi. in a way that we should become the true waiters of Imam Mahdi. And this waiting is the power of Islam, because we are living with the hope, we are waiting for someone who will save us, and we know that whatever is going on the earth, the injustice, the wrong doings, there is someone who will come and who will save us from this injustice and who will spread justice amongst the people. So the power of Islam is waiting for Imam Mahdi at this time, and we must provide the grounds for the reappearance while we are waiting for Imam Mahdi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Economic divide.
Did you know that there was a global economic meltdown that is taking place? This is no scare tactic, believe me. We all know that COVID-19 pandemic has dented the world economic growth, affecting businesses and people's livelihoods. Hi, I'm Kamit Halfway. In this edition of Economic Divide, we'll tell you how the entire world has been propped up by central banks around the world, accumulating massive deficits in the process. Now, coming up in today's program, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the world economy. But did you know by how much and how badly? How does $834 million an hour sound? And that is to keep the economy alive. Then, the key question needs to be asked, why did central banks have to do that? Why do they have to print money? To help companies stay afloat during lockdowns, which led to the biggest stock market rally of a generation. And finally, we're going to take a look at the central bank's function, how they absorb so much of the bond market, more than $16 trillion in debt with a negative yield to have been accumulated. Is this a debt time bomb that's overdue, waiting to happen? and debt, they go hand in hand, and there was plenty of that going on around the world last year. Governments, households, and companies raised $24 trillion last year to offset the pandemic's economic toll. By doing that, the global debt was pushed to an all-time high of almost $300 trillion. That is more than the 355% of global GDP, according to the Institute of International Finance. And there's even more borrowing ahead. The COVID pandemic has added $24 trillion to the global debt mountain over last year. That means that the debt as a ratio of world economic output, known as gross domestic product, has surged by 35 percentage points to over 355% of world GDP. This is well beyond the rise seen during the global financial crisis, and there's also little sign of a near-term stabilization. Borrowing levels are expected to run well above pre-COVID levels in many countries and sectors again this year, supported by still low interest rates, although the reopening of economies should help on the GDP side of the equation. The IIF has said we expect global government debt to increase by another $10 trillion this year and to surpass $92 trillion, adding that winding down support could also prove even more challenging than it was after the financial crisis. The problem with debt and money printing is that they are short-term solutions with long-term problems, which puts the future generations at risk. Let's not forget that the 2008 financial crisis, which started in the U.S. and spread across the world, had large stimulus spending. If you recall, they were called bailouts. The U.S. government spent around $700 billion, called the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. The EU amount, though, came in at a much higher cost. How could anyone forget the then ECB central bank chief Mario Draghi, who said the ECB will do whatever it takes to save the euro? That whatever it takes amounts to 2 trillion euros. Well, joining us for a cost breakdown, literally, is Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University. He also holds a PhD in political economy and is the author of The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. Well, Jack, welcome. Global central banks led by the U.S. Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and also the Bank of Japan, unbelievably have collectively spent $834 million an hour, that's $13.9 million per minute, for the past 18 months to keep businesses rolling. I mean, it's hard to even wrap our mind around that figure. What does that mean? I mean, does it mean if it didn't do that, the world economy would fall apart?
Well, you know, you got to distinguish between central bank balance sheet debt, which you started talking about, and what the sovereign governments undertake in terms of debt on their spending programs and tax programs. And then you probably should talk about the local government, provinces, states, and so forth, which aren't even in that data. And then there's household debt and there's corporate business debt.
All right, but that doesn't answer the question as to why there are reports that so much money has actually been spent by these central banks. I mean, on what sector is this money being spent on?
The level of debt by itself is not the whole problem. You can have an increasing level of debt as long as the economy, the real economy, is growing. GDP is growing. Of course, it hasn't been. What's important is the ability to service that excess debt. Service meaning pay the principal and interest down the road. When you can't pay the principal and interest, that's when you have defaults. Now, sovereign debt, you're not going to default. Certainly not in the United States. The U.S. can monetize that debt, print money, whatever, right? But corporate debt is another question. And household debt is another question, and even state and local government debt is another question. We shall see whether the consequence of this COVID-exacerbated global recession, which is still with us, not just COVID still with us, but the recession still with us, What you got is a rebound of the economy in the U.S. You don't have a sustained recovery yet. We shall see whether the real economy is going to generate enough income to service that massive debt addition that's occurred here. You know, just to take the Federal Reserve.
It's time now for our Info News section. As you're well aware by now, here's where we pick up stories that best reflect the theme of our program, social inequality, poverty, and injustice. Now, first up, an event that would have taken place by the time you're watching this program, and that is the UN Food Summit. Now, the summit said that it's not going to achieve anything meaningful because of corporations, and this is pretty important. And the reason why it said that is because it says that the corporations have engineered our current broken food systems. So that is what needs to be addressed by the summit, if that is something that will actually get done. That is the key question. On to Europe and gas prices there. You're well aware by now, gas prices there are skyrocketing. Obviously, that's going to pose a big worry for the EU economy as a whole. European gas prices have been hitting record highs. What is the reason behind that? Well, some say it's due to low storage volumes and the fast approaching winter, but low supplies from Russia and uncertainty about the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline are other reasons. And also the lack of drivers. It is said that they need 90,000 drivers to actually deliver the fuel. So that's another reason for this. And talk about oil. China's oil imports is our next topic. China has cut its oil imports and has ramped up purchases of natural gas, and it has reduced its crude imports by 5.7% since the start of 2021. At the same time, it has boosted natural gas purchases by over 20%. It seems that independent refineries slowed their restocking due to official probes into trading and taxes. Then moving on here to AI technology, big concern, the UN Human Rights Chief coming out calling for a global halt to sales of dangerous AI technologies. Why is she calling AI technologies dangerous? Well, yes, AI has to serve people, that's undeniable, but AI's ability to feed human rights violations or to commit human rights violations, to be part of that, at an enormous scale with virtually no visibility, that is a problem. And her remarks came at the hearing of the Pegasus scandal, the Israeli spyware firm which was used to target civilians.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section of the program. For this topic, we're going to take a look at what's called QE and what it means and how it functions in order to get a better idea of why this program has been popular. Now, quantitative easing, or QE as it is called, is referred to the introduction of new money into the money supply by a central bank. Now, this process, quantitative easing, helps the economy. How does it do that? It reduces long-term interest rates, making businesses and mortgage borrowing cheaper, and by signaling the Fed's intention to keep using monetary policy to support the economy. Now, the Fed turns to this process, QE, when short-term interest rates actually fall nearly to zero and the economy still needs help. In response to the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Federal Reserve has actually done some things regarding the QE. It has cut the short-term interest rate down to zero. That happened on March 15, 2020, and restarted its large-scale asset purchases, more commonly known as quantitative easing, or QE. And since July of 2020, the Fed has been buying $80 billion of Treasury securities and $40 billion of agency mortgage-backed securities each month. Now, the potentially imminent decision by the Fed to begin reducing this $120 billion in monthly asset purchases The Fed Chair Powell said that the weeks since the Fed's policy meeting in July brought more progress towards repairing the jobs market, with nearly a million positions added, and that progress should continue.
Today, the Federal Open Market Committee kept interest rates near zero and maintained our current pace of asset purchases. These measures, along with our strong guidance on interest rates and on our balance sheet, will ensure that monetary policy will continue to support the economy until the recovery is complete.
Obviously, the key there, until the recovery is complete. However, this also coincided with the further spread, unfortunate for the U.S. and the world, of the Delta variant.
What happened was Delta happened, and you have this very sharp spike in Delta cases, and I think so that affects, for example, when schools are open 60% of the time or when they're always at a threat of being closed because of Delta, the Delta variant. You know, you might want to wait rather than going ahead and taking a job and starting work only to have to quit it 3 weeks later. You're going to wait until you're confident of that.
Yeah, obviously there the Fed is explaining the QE program, why it needs to continue, because he says one reason is that people are going to go out there and get a job, but yet they're going to have to quit because of COVID. They're not going to do that. Well, the further spread of the Delta variant did obviously affect the Fed's plan to reduce this QE. Nevertheless, the Federal Reserve on September 22nd cleared the way to reduce its monthly bond purchases soon, as it said, and then signaled interest rate increases may follow more quickly than expected. This would involve 9 of 18 U.S. central bank policymakers who have projected borrowing costs will need to rise in 2022.
At the Federal Reserve, we are strongly committed to achieving the monetary policy goals that Congress has given us, maximum employment and price stability. Today, the Federal Open Market Committee kept interest rates near zero and maintained our current pace of asset purchases. These measures, along with our strong guidance on interest rates and on our balance sheet, will ensure that monetary policy will continue to support the economy until the recovery is complete.
Let's try to get an idea about this QE. We have Justin Urquhart-Stewart joining us. He's director of the Seven Investment Management and founder and head corporate development at the investment fund 7IM. Justin, welcome. How does the QE work? We know that it involves the printing of money. We also know that the New York Fed and the ECB have printed lots of money, even the ECB said to have negative interest rates. Tell us how this whole process gets executed.
It's fascinating when you look at quantitative easing, because you find any economics book of, say, 30 years ago, and there will be no mention of it at all. So this is a relatively new phenomenon in terms of its description and its application by central banks. All it is, in fact, is you're getting the government to be issuing debt, and then its central bank is then buying its debt. And therefore, what you're doing is it creating that value, which you can then call printing money. But effectively, what they're doing is putting more money into the system. Now, that could work quite well. Of course, the clever thing is, if you think that the bank, central bank and the state are one and the same, then they've got the items on both sides of the balance sheet. You have the assets and the debt. So in theory, because they're one and the same, in due course, they can match them up and wipe them out. But they can't do that yet, because it would lose that vital word that runs any economy, which is confidence. And they have to have confidence in those central banks so they know what they're doing. And I have to say, at the moment, there's a real concern when you look at the central banks, because they're now trying to ease the market forward to say to them, interest rates are going to go up, but they are not going to go up now, so there's no need to panic. And this is what we had a few years back when you had something known as the Tapier tantrum. They were going to taper down the level of quantitative easing, the levels of borrowing, and be able to try and make sure there is still support in the economy, and therefore interest rates will start going up from where they are at the moment, as you correctly said, when they were negative. So the market's going to watch this very carefully indeed, and it's going to be an incredibly sensitive issue. Now, overlay on that the aftershocks of COVID, we haven't resolved that all of that issue, but overlay on that the geopolitical issues, particularly between America and China, and we have some very big risks to manage during this. So it's going to be a sensitive time with a very, very sensitive financial subject.
The money that the world is awash in is truly worrying. One thing not even covered in this program is the world of dark money. Anyways, all in all, the world is drowning in cash and in turn debt. The question that then arises is, how can this amount of debt ever be repaid? Well, of course it can't. the World Economic Forum blatantly admitted so. It said that at the end of 2015, Greece's public debt was 176% of its GDP, while Japan's debt ratio was 248%. The U.S. stands at 125%. None of these governments will ever repay all that they owe. Write-offs and monetization are inevitable. Total world public debt, 215% and rising. That was back in the year 2016. Rejoining us for this final Q&A of the program is Jack Rasmus, professor of economics. And also we have Justin Yerquart, Stewart, director of the Seven Investment Management. Jack, my final question to you. According to strategists at Bank of America, trillions of dollars, euros, and yen have been created to shore up global financial systems, provide the much-needed liquidity. But given the QE and stimulus back from the 2008 financial crisis, isn't the world awash with so much debt that it's nearly impossible for it to repay back?
Well, it's not only awash with debt, but it's awash with an incredible amount of liquidity, money capital all over the place. That's why these stock markets are not really correcting. There's so much trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines in investors' hands that whenever the market starts going down a little, they commit more of this liquidity money. They pump it back up. They just keep buying the dips, and there's no corrections going on anymore because there's so much money that the feds and central banks have thrown into the global economy. How long can this go? Well, the whole question is how long will the central banks keep throwing this money, especially Western central banks, into their economies and creating these financial asset bubbles?
Well, Justin, that sounds like a good question that I could throw at you. For how long can this then go on, which, as our guest Jack Rasmus indicated, has created this financial bubbles with all this money being pumped into the system, giving QE and stimulus from the 2008 financial crisis? Isn't the world now awash with so much debt? Again, my question, that there's no way that it can possibly repay it back?
The answer to the question is actually in the question itself. The world is awash with all this debt. And the question is, therefore, can it be sustained? Well, it can be sustained as long as you have that vital word of confidence again, or you'll have that other phrase, which is the emperor's new clothes. That's to say, does everyone stop losing confidence in actually what's happening? And then they start selling, and that's when you'll see a real danger to the global economy. So the central bankers have to manage this very carefully indeed. We have eye-watering amounts of debt, which, after all, neither you nor I can actually get enough numbers, enough noughts on our calculators to actually see it. So what they need to do is manage it over the longer term. They've got inflation beginning to rise, which is quite helpful because it starts to erode the value of the debt. But inflation has a nasty habit of getting out of hand, so they've got to be careful. If they raise interest rates too quickly, they'll frighten the market. And if you raise interest rates at all, the cost of that debt does go up. And that's going to be a large cost, which, frankly, none of these nations are really prepared to be able to manage effectively.
Global debt is spiraling out of control and is fast approaching record $300 trillion. It seems like many countries are after debt restructuring for taking on too much debt, especially after the economic fallout due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Hoy tenemos es que el 99% de la deuda pública en moneda extranjera bajo ley extranjera ya ha quedado reestructurada.
Las deudas hoy nos permite lograr que en los próximos 10 años el país libere más de 16,000 millones de dólares del pago de deuda.
Even Europe's economic powerhouse, Germany, is plagued with debt, so much so that it had to come out and defend its borrowing. That, of course, is a rare thing, like for one of the biggest holders of debt, namely the U.S. It holds so much debt that it can default on its national debt by not raising its ceiling.
It is imperative that Congress address the debt limit. If not, our current estimate is that Treasury will likely exhaust its extraordinary measures by October 18th.
Total debt levels are measured by levels accrued in government, household, corporate, and bank debt. Here is an outline of the $300 trillion. Starting from the year 2014, the figure stood at around $210 trillion, and slowly it increased until the spike happened in 2020 when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, bringing the total global debt to around $300 trillion. The countries with the most external debt are listed here based on their ranking. The U.S. at number one, followed by the United Kingdom, France, Germany, then Japan. And based on this borrowing trend, the IIF, the Institute of International Finance, has said that if the borrowing continues at this pace, we expect global debt to exceed $300 trillion. But even before the pandemic, debt levels were not sustainable, especially for developing countries and the world's poorest nations. COVID-19 has increased the challenge exponentially. The rise in developing countries' total debt is at its highest level on record. It is at 193% of the GDP in 2018. This is while the global debt is 260% of GDP by end of 2021. But the borrowing started way before the pandemic, so it's not just about COVID-19. At the start of the decade, the ratio was close to 300%, and in 2008, it was 280%. The first UN ministerial roundtable, called UNCTAD, dealt with the COVID-19 emergency, and debt accumulation was one of the topics.
Our planet faces an unprecedented health, social, and economic crisis, one that puts every nation on Earth in danger.
The Prime Minister of Barbados issued a stern warning.
We are either going to find ourselves servicing debt or servicing people.
Let's take a look at what she has actually said. Let it sink in. We are either going to find ourselves serving debt or servicing people. We have to make the choice. Tough words, but the truth. High borrowing levels will have profound consequences for the global economy. But the biggest question of all is, will this debt ever get repaid? Please write to us.
The global economy has taken a severe hit from the COVID-19 pandemic. No questions about that. On top of that, as a consequence, supply chains and links have been broken, which means that many third world countries that are part of that, for example, have gone out of business. That gives further strain on production or overall providing goods and services. Now, this means that there really was no option for this stimulus. But the repayment of this debt, that's the key question. With so much money pumped into the system, well, inflation is sure to follow, as it has, like in food prices and other major commodities. Well, according to one economist, this debt can never be repaid. And that could lead to the bankruptcy of nations and central banks that created that debt, like the U.S. and the U.K. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was good to have you with us. From Mikko Vetäväinen and the entire team, is goodbye until next time.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.